And welcome in to hour number two of Downtown on your Friday afternoon. Well, of course, that theme music written by Paul Anka, the iconic theme from The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And our next guest knew Johnny perhaps as well as anybody did or anybody could as his lawyer. And as he describes in his book, counselor, partner, tennis pal, business advisor, enforcer, drinking and dining companion, and more, Henry Bushkin joins us on the telephone. Henry, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You had to know that your time working as a young lawyer with Johnny Carson was going to be interesting when your first sort of official job was to break into an apartment that he believed his wife was using for a tryst with Frank Gifford.
Exactly. We didn't know it was Frank Gifford. We suspected it was a tryst. And yeah, that led to an 18-year relationship. Where I was first hired for that caper to be there in case the cops showed up because of this potential break into that apartment.
Well, you were, I believe, 27 years old when you were hired to work with Carson, and that had to be a little overwhelming at first because he was such an iconic figure.
Absolutely, and of course, what goes through your mind is this is a one shot. You can hire me to go along on this caper, and then I'll never hear from him again. And fortunately, the next day, I heard from him. We met at a bar that evening, and the following day, he asked me to file a divorce against his wife.
Now, at the time, and I believe, this, if I remember the story from the book, when you went to meet with him, you ran into his manager outside of the apartment, and that was the legendary owner of the Jets and promoter and manager, Sonny Werblin.
Yeah, I actually met Sonny at Johnny's apartment prior to the adventurous break-in. And yeah, he was a very well-known guy. He was the guy, as you recall, who signed Joe Namath for the Jets. And funnily enough, I was watching last night an HBO special on Joe Namath, and I became partners with Jimmy Walsh, who was Joe Namath's attorney and agent and has been since 1965.
Now, you worked with Johnny for nearly two decades. You certainly helped him achieve great success in the business world, helped him negotiate his way through some marriages and relationships along the way, and then the relationship ended. And as most relationships with Johnny, when they ended for good.
And they ended badly in the sense that when his relationship with Joan Rivers ended, he never spoke to her again. When his relationships with his wives ended, he never spoke to them again. And the same thing was true with me. Although we did speak with one, I did speak with him one time subsequent to my being terminated by him. That was when his son Rick died in 1992.
We're talking with Henry Bushkin, the author of the book Johnny Carson, and a brand new epilogue to that book, Mommy Dearest. And in that epilogue, you certainly talk a lot about his mother, Ruth, and the impact that she had on him. And with the work of a psychologist, too, a pretty clear picture of a guy who seemed to be a classic narcissist.
Yeah, that was the conclusion that was reached pretty early on when I was writing this article, because we know that Ruth Carson was cold. We know that she didn't show Johnny any type of affection when he was a little kid. And we know in later life she was never pleased with her son, no matter how many things he gave her, no matter how great his accomplishments or success. And so growing up, he had to find his own source of comfort because he wasn't getting it from his mother. And then that manifested itself as a young magician, and he became quite skilled at it. And he was quick to say that he got all the comfort he needed from the audience. You know, when he got that applause, that really took the place of comfort, of parental comfort, which he was never getting from his mom. And of course, when I wrote this, it was after the book was written, and all the information in this epilogue was found out after the book was written. And so Ruth Carson had a very traumatic childhood herself. It was tragic. And I think one learns that the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree.
Now, you got to know Johnny about as well as it sounds like anybody could. And you also in the book talk about the fact that this was a guy who certainly kept people at arm's length and had difficulty in relationship with women in particular. But he was also a guy who could be very, very kind and very generous.
Absolutely. And I should point out that if you were interviewing Johnny and you'd ask him what type of personality he had, he'd say it's basically an unhappy one. In other words, his basic comfort level was being a little unhappy. If things were going very well, he would somehow find a way to bring it off kilter somewhat. And there are many examples of that where things were going so good, and I had to say to myself, why is he doing that? Why is he taking a circumstance that's so good and making it so bad? His honeymoon cruise with his last wife was a good example of that, where everything was going swimmingly well, and he found ways to make it very unpleasant.
You talked about his unhappiness, and didn't Sonny Werblin introduce him to you as the second unhappiest man in the world?
And he did that in front of Johnny, which was shocking to me that he actually said it in front of Johnny. And the first, the number one unhappiest man in the world was Jack Benny, according to Sonny Werblin. And, of course, Jack Benny was Johnny's idol. So it all sort of fit. The puzzle was sort of complete.
In all the years that you knew him, did Johnny Carson change as time went on?
Oh, I think he did. And if you recall, he retired in 1992, and you never heard from him again. And he effectively became his mother, because he ended all relationships. Ed McMahon, for example, was asked if he spoke to Johnny regularly after he retired. And Ed responded by saying he spoke to him maybe one time a year. Now, these guys were arm-in-arm buddies in New York. Their relationship was slightly different in California, but they were show business pals for many, many years, and Ed spoke to him maybe one time a year. And the sad part is Johnny died all alone. There was no funeral. There was no memorial for him. And so I say he really turned into his mother, a little bit bitter, a little bit uncomfortable around anybody. And, of course, his mother was uncomfortable around him, but comfortable around other people. So there was that dichotomy.
When the book first came out, there were those people who were critical of you and said this was your opportunity to get back at a guy who fired you. What was your response to them? And as you look at it now, a couple of years later, what do you view as your motivation for writing the story of Johnny Carson?
Well, I could tell you exactly what it was. I was writing a novel based upon travels I had made through Saudi Arabia and China and Central Asia. And as you know, if you travel like that, you sit in airports a great deal of the time. And so I started writing in airports and on airplanes. And then when I was home and I showed some of my pages to a friend of mine, he said, "Why are you bothering with this novel? Why don't you write the book about Johnny Carson? Everybody wants to know about Johnny Carson." And the person who said that to me was a guy by the name of Ed Hoekstraten, who became Johnny's lawyer after me. So he's the one who encouraged me to write the book, and I never intended to write this book. And I started in 2008, and it came out in 2013.
So how do you choose to remember Johnny Carson?
Well, all of these interviews, and as you can imagine, when the book first came out, I probably did 500 interviews from newspapers, television, radio, and so on. And I tend to think of him as this brilliant performer who was a complex human being, and the complexity deserves to be known because he was that important a guy to the entertainment world, to television, to the business world. So I look at him as this towering figure that I've shared with the public, and you're right. I mean, people criticized me, people praised me, but you have to understand that reading a book is like a Rorschach test. If you held Johnny on this very high pedestal, anything that might be construed as negative might cause you not to read the book or to dislike the book. But I think I'm gratified by all the responses to the book, and as you know, in the business, you tend not to take these things personally. So, but I'm happy about the book. I'm happy that Johnny is back in the forefront of pop culture, and I think the book helped in part to do that.
And I personally thought it was a very balanced portrayal of him, and I learned a lot about him as a longtime fan, like so many others. Does it make it, when I read this epilogue, I found myself feeling sorry for him more than I thought I would. Does it make it even more sad that a guy who was so beloved by most of the American population who watched him for all those years on The Tonight Show, and it didn't seem like it brought him anywhere near the pleasure that it should have?
That's the sad part, isn't it? That a guy who literally had everything. When I left in 1988, he was making $25 million a year. So imagine that. He was making about $500,000 a week, and he had 37 weeks on and 15 weeks off. And by the time he retired in 1992, he was making, I believe, around $40 million a year, and he died all alone. He died on his yacht. I mean, they took him from his yacht to the hospital, and there was no memorial for him. And so it's this terribly sad ending to a brilliant career as perhaps the best late-night television host of all time. I think if you ask anybody today, probably they'll say that Johnny Carson was the gold standard in late-night television.
Henry Bushkin, the author of Johnny Carson and the epilogue to that entitled Mommy Dearest, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon and sharing some insight into the king of late night. We really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.